This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. It's time once again to discuss this past week's important news with our panel. Here in the studio, we have Jeremiah Jacques.
Hello there.
And Andrew Miller.
Hello.
From our office in Britain, we have Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
And from our office in Jerusalem, Brent Nachtigall.
Hello.
A happy anniversary to the Philadelphia Church of God. As you may have heard this morning on the Trumpet Daily Radio Show, it was 29 years ago today that this organization became necessary when founder Gerald Flory was fired as a minister of the Worldwide Church of God for holding fast to the teachings of Herbert W. Armstrong. Well, he continued to hold fast, and the Trumpet was one outgrowth of that, this magazine and subsequently a website and then a radio station that continues in the work Mr. Armstrong did of evaluating the news in light of the prophecies of the Bible. And it's a tremendous blessing to be able to do this work. And we're very happy to be able to share it with you, our listeners. We're going to start in Israel. A startling report this week showed the aggressive determination of the nation's enemies in preparing for a massive attack on the Jewish state. For this, we'll turn to our man in Jerusalem, Brent Nachtigall.
For a number of years, Israeli residents that live along the border with Lebanon in the north have claimed that they've heard some type of noises coming from underneath their properties. And for a number of years, the army has said that they can't determine whether there is any tunneling operations going on from southern Lebanon into Israeli territory. But over the last 2 years, the army has acquired the ability to detect such activity. And so starting on Tuesday, overnight Monday into Tuesday, the IDF has started an operation called Northern Shield, whereby they are uncovering now these tunnels that Hezbollah, the terrorist entity, really the terrorist army that exists in southern Lebanon that answers to Iran and is funded by Iran, that they have made into Israeli territory. So far, since this began on Tuesday, two of these tunnels have been found. These are attack tunnels. They are extremely well made. The one that was discovered on Tuesday morning is, I guess, 20 meters below the ground, 80 feet or so below the ground. It's carved through rock. It goes for 200 meters. It's 6 feet by 6 feet. It starts in Lebanon underneath some type of concrete facility, I guess, and then it travels 40 meters into Israeli territory. And so they uncovered this. Apparently, it took 2 years for Hezbollah to build this one tunnel, and the Israelis uncovered this. They sent a robot down there into it, and lo and behold, on Tuesday morning, there was a Hezbollah engineer that was down there that approached this Israeli robot, and Israelis have this on video. And, you know, this robot disintegrated as this Hezbollah engineer who has a doctorate, who studied in Iran. We know who he is. He was captured in film running away from this robot. And so this is just absolute proof of the brazen attempts that Hezbollah, backed by Iran, is making to infiltrate Israeli sovereign territory.
So you're talking about the quality of these tunnels. This isn't just 80 feet below ground through rock. This is a like a permanent type fixture where they're not just kind of, I guess Hamas, those tunnels that have come from the Gaza border have just been a bit more amateurish, and maybe they're enough to get a couple of guys over, kidnap a soldier or something and bring them back. This seems to have a much more forcible purpose.
For sure. And one thing that's good about Iran and Hezbollah is they tell you what they're doing, and they tell you what they're planning on doing. And so for the past 4 or 5 years, Hezbollah has said that they have an operation which is called Conquer the Galilee, which refers to the northern part of Israel, to the north of the Sea of Galilee and the area along their border with Lebanon, Israel's border with Lebanon. And they have said that they want to swap this territory with their soldiers, with their commandos. And they didn't tell us how they were going to do that necessarily, but they said that this was their goal. They were going to do this under the barrage of missiles overhead. And so Israel would be preoccupied with the missiles and then infiltrate Israel and cut off Israeli territory or communities, Israeli communities. This from the goal that they had from this tunnel, the specific tunnel that was discovered on Tuesday, was to cut off a northern town of Matula, which is basically on a peninsula of land, if you can call it that, of Israeli territory that's surrounded mostly by Lebanese territory. These are not, as you say, tunnels to go and grab somebody, bring them back, and use them as a bargaining chip in the future with Israel for some type of deal. This is to invade. These are to invade Israel. Hezbollah said they were going to do it, and now they have been working probably for about 4 or 5 years on these tunnel systems to do exactly that. And Israel has decided that it's time now to destroy these tunnels. They have known about the tunnels for some time, for it looks like for about a year and a half. They've known that Hezbollah was making them, but now is the opportune time or the time where it's become too risky to not deal with it. So that Israel is going there to try and destroy them. This operation looks like it's going to go for a couple of weeks. The IDF suspects there's going to be about 10 or 11 of these tunnels that they will find.
So you said that this plan that Hezbollah and Iran have announced, Conquer the Galilee, that it involves a combination of sending the soldiers through these tunnels and missile attacks. And we're looking at Hezbollah in Lebanon possessing upwards of 120,000 missiles. They definitely have the hardware that they need in order to, they could really overwhelm Israel's defenses just with that.
Yeah, Israel, and I would say no modern nation in the last few decades have witnessed the barrage that Hezbollah could lay on Israel with their missiles. And most of the time we just talk about the missiles. Those missiles can hit a lot of them can hit anywhere in Israel, all the way north to south. They're not Hamas style rockets that, you know, hit within 10 to 15 kilometers of Gaza. These can hit everyone in Israel. And we know that they now have these precision systems that can allow these rockets these missiles to locate hit targets. Now, they're all not 130,000 of them or whatever are fitted with the GPS systems, but some are, which then make these missiles more accurate, which then would initiate Israel's defensive missile shield, because Israel's defensive missile shield only targets missiles that are going to hit populated centers. Well, if you increase the number of these missiles that are going to hit populated centers, you're going to overwhelm Israel's defense as far as the missile capability goes. And so that threat still remains. Now, it's seen that the fact that Israel is choosing to destroy these tunnels first, that this is only step one in a preemptive war that Israel is going to, or preemptive attack that Israel is going to wage against Hezbollah in southern Lebanon. People have suspected that coming into early next year, that there will be an attack on the actual missile areas that Hezbollah controls. But don't forget, one in three houses in southern Lebanon are a Hezbollah weapons cache, fire launch pad depot, or a place where they're going to launch missiles from. They are assets of Hezbollah. And so for Israel to try and cull those or get rid of that threat of missiles, it's going to involve air power. You're going to wipe out a lot of civilians. It's going to have to involve some type of invasion as well. Now, that's looking ahead, but Israel is going to...
That's why Netanyahu is saying Hezbollah is threatening Lebanese civilians. He's putting Lebanese civilians in danger because it's forcing Israel's hand to have to take that kind of action.
Yeah, Israel can't live with this threat. especially when you saw what happened on November 13th with Hamas, the other terrorist entity backed by Iran, fired all those rockets, 400 plus rockets. At the time, we said, "What? Why is Israel not responding? Why aren't they going in hard?" Well, at the Security Cabinet meeting on November 13th, Mr. Netanyahu told everyone about this project that was coming up to destroy all the Hezbollah tunnels. And they said, let's hold back on Hamas because we have this greater threat to the north. And so Israel is already cornered in how they can act because of the huge threat that's just sitting there that can be activated by Iran whenever they want to. I think the most important thing about this for people to recognize is that Iran does say they want to just destroy the Jewish state. But they are putting down concrete plans to do so. They're constructing these tunnels that are to invade a country. This is real. These aren't just threats to gain some type of political advantage over another nation. They actually have plans to do exactly what they say they're going to do, which does speak to Bible prophecy about what we've said about Iran for the past 20 years. Mr. Flory, our editor-in-chief, has talked about Iran leading this radical Islamist camp that is extremely destabilizing, that has a foreign policy of push, a foreign policy which makes other nations have to defend themselves because Iran or the King of the South isn't going to stop. And we've labeled Iran as that King of the South for the past 20 years. And when we see proof like this, that they're actually preparing to invade Israel, I think that is strong validation of those prophecies made so long ago.
Well, if you have not read it, you need to read Gerald Flory's booklet, The King of the South, which explains the biblically prophetic underpinning behind that statement and what we've been saying about Iran for decades now that is borne out by the news that you've revealed to us today. We really do appreciate that, Brent. Paris has been besieged by riots as people protest taxes on fuel. Well, the French president has given in to the protesters. It's quite an interesting story. To learn about this, we'll go to our man in Britain, Richard Palmer.
Yes, you've had massive numbers of demonstrators taking to the streets around Paris's most iconic monuments. There's graffiti sprayed on the Arc de Triomphe. I think that just saw a headline today about the Eiffel Towers being closed ahead of this weekend so that protesters can't gather around that. They've also been targeting rich districts. There was one journalist who talked about one particular part of Paris where he said, well, there wasn't a single bank that didn't have their front windows smashed. There wasn't a single Mercedes, Porsche, or BMW that hadn't been attacked and many burned. So massive street protests and street violence in France. Now, the immediate cause for all of this is a new plan of a tax on diesel and on car fuel, lorry fuel. And so the protesters that they've taken to the streets at first, Emmanuel Macron tried to ignore the problem. Then he eventually said, we're going to freeze these planned tax increases. That didn't stop the protests. Now he said we're going to cancel them. Though so far, I mean, we'll have to see what happens this weekend, but that still doesn't seem to have slowed the protests much.
So these taxes that he's put in place, tell us the purpose of the taxes.
So these are environmental taxes. These are to meet Emmanuel Macron's climate change goals. He needs to impose these, he needs to get people to use or generate less carbon dioxide and carbon monoxide. So in order to do that, in order to meet these goals that he's set for the country and for himself and he's signed up to, including in things like the Paris Climate Change Accords, he's got to get people to burn less fuel. And so this is part of his whole spectrum of measures to do that. You make it more expensive. You make it more expensive for people to drive their cars around. And the idea is they use them less. You have less fuel. And fuel taxes are a big deal over here. One of my favorite parts about visiting the United States, because I was over there in October, is filling up my car. I am so happy when I fill up my car in the United States and I come away and I'm like, it only costs $30 to fill my tank up. I don't believe it.
Yeah.
Because over here, that could cost $100 when you've got at the high end when you've got petrol prices at kind of their peak. So it's all environmentalism is a big part of it. Of course, cynically, I'm sure a good chunk of it is to raise money for the government as well.
So, but in other words, the protesting on the street, you could accurately characterize it as the public's response to the measures that came about as a result of Paris Climate Accords and those types of greening type measures.
Oh, absolutely. On the one hand, I don't think France has even met their Paris Climate Change Accord goals. But this is their attempt to get there. And yeah, there's a lot of people. I've seen quite a lot of people talking about this. I think there was one headline along the lines of, "Well, this is trying to meet the Paris Climate Change Accords on the backs of the world's poor." But yeah, absolutely, this is all about that global. All about those climate change accords. Really, this is once you look at what it looks like in practice. The streets of Paris are what it looks like in practice.
Right, right. So, talk about just the economic reforms that Macron has been making, and how this also represents some dissatisfaction with those.
Right. So, some of the protests on the streets are affiliated with Antifa, European version. I think Antifa has affiliated themselves with Black Bloc over in Europe, and some of these far left protesters. And you kind of think, well, what are they doing out on the streets protesting climate change? Because aren't they meant to be all in favor of these kind of taxes? But what you start to get a picture of is, these taxes are, the most immediate and definitely the biggest thing on people's minds. But there's this whole background of reforms that they are protesting against. There's people talking about, well, we're not satisfied with whatever Macron does. We want him gone. That's the only thing that's going to satisfy us. So for a significant number of people on the streets, they're protesting all of the reforms that Macron's made. And his whole policy for his economics, aside from this climate change agenda, has been, we're going to do what Germany wants, and we're going to try and set ourselves up to be Germany's sidekick in the EU. So we'll show Germany that we can reform our economy, and we'll be at Germany's side when we try to persuade other countries to reform their economies. And then that way we can hopefully persuade Germany to give up some of its money and to allow some of its money to be used to mold the Eurozone into this much more cohesive, single, solid whole, and to use some of its money for things like a European army. And so Germany's been unwilling to hand over a lot of its money because it doesn't want to subsidize inefficient countries. It doesn't want to have, say, people getting generous welfare in France while there's much stricter welfare conditions within Germany, and German taxpayers feel like, well, we're getting ripped off so the French can live at ease. So as that, Germany's big condition is always, you've got to reform. Now Emmanuel Macron's been putting in those reforms, and what we see on the streets is also an outcome of that.
Yeah. So we talk often about the biblical prophecy of a European Union being a mixture of iron and miry clay, that it has all kinds of problems really coalescing. And it seems this is very much along those lines. Here you have a leader who's trying to make this work, and you have a populace or a good segment of the populace that is kicking up a significant fuss about that. This seems to demonstrate just yet again how I think in a lot of ways Gerald Fleury's been talking about how Macron, he would love to kind of step up into the role of a major European leader, and you know, I think he said something to the effect that he's delusional if he really thinks that way, but this is another measure of just how weak and leaderless Europe is at present, isn't it?
It is. It's really undermining. I mean, he wants, now that, I mean, right as we speak, Germany's CDU party is getting together to choose a new leader. And so Merkel's very much on the wane. And I think this is Emmanuel Macron is he's been preparing to step forward now as the new Mr. Europe, now that Angela Merkel's on the way out. And this is very much tripping him up as he does this. I think it's also interesting if you look at Mr. Fleury's Key of David episode that just went online today. he talks about, it's a really powerful Key of David, and he focuses a lot on the European army. But at the start, he focused on some comments from Macron where he says, well, France loves Germany. And he says, well, I think this comment is a good sign that he's just concluded that I'm just going to throw my lot in with Germany. We'll kind of, you know, we'll follow their lead, or we'll facilitate what they want to do. And he probably wants to try and emerge as the head with that, but he's just thrown in the lot with Germany. You look at the economic policies that have provoked these riots that we see on the streets, and it's exactly that. That is literally his economic policy. We'll throw in a lot with Germany. We'll make these changes that Germany wants to try and get Germany's money. And then you see, yeah, you know, it's still the iron in the clay. There's still that disunion there. But that economic policy is just a reflection of exactly what Mr. Flory was talking about on today's Key of David.
Well, I would definitely encourage every listener to go and look at that Key of David program that's up on the website today. It's France is Betraying America and Fulfilling Bible Prophecy, Part 3, the third of three programs that Gerald Flory has given on the subject of France in prophecy. I look forward to seeing that, and definitely go check that out for more information about what's happening over there in France. We appreciate that very much. Richard, you're listening to Trumpet Hour, our week in review program on 101.3 KPCG. While Hezbollah has been preparing a physical attack on Israel, as we talked about earlier, China has been preparing an economic attack on the U.S. dollar and its place in global finance. We've been tracking these efforts for years, and recently they've been having some alarming success. For this story, we'll go to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, it was just about 8 months ago now that China launched an oil futures contract that's denominated in the Chinese currency, the yuan or renminbi. And now the contract is really beginning to be embraced by a fair number of global commodities traders. We spoke about this oil futures contract earlier this year when China first launched it on the Shanghai International Energy Exchange. And at that time, some analysts were, you know, reasonably worried about the threat that it could potentially pose to the U.S. dollar. But for the most part, the onlookers and experts said that it didn't pose a viable threat to the dollar. But now here we are with 8 months to look back over, and it's easy to see that this contract really is finding more and more acceptance among multinational commodity traders. Trading volumes for the new contract have already surpassed contracts traded in Tokyo and Singapore. Most recently, they just overtook those traded on the Dubai Mercantile Exchange. So that made the new Chinese contract the world's third most popular benchmark, only after the West Texas Intermediate and then Europe's Brent Blend. So the Shanghai contract it's really taking off. I've got a quote here from Stephen Inns of the Oanda Futures Brokerage. He said, "The Shanghai contract has become an unexpected thorn in the side of the main Western benchmarks. The pace of expansion has been explosive." And then there was also a report published this week by Project Syndicate, just showing that the trade volumes of these Chinese contract is set to further expand. And that report said China is pursuing de-dollarization head on. So it really looks like if this momentum continues, this new Chinese oil futures contract could just be a pretty powerful tool to erode the power of the U.S. dollar.
Well, talk about how much the effect we're already seeing of this, how much of a share of the market has China already claimed?
Yes, after 8 months, the contract traded on the Shanghai International Energy Exchange now has a 16% share of the global market for the shortest term oil futures. That's according to data compiled by the Hong Kong-based Gevacol research company. And Gevacol said that during that same time frame, West Texas Intermediate, which is the world's most followed benchmark, saw its market share drop from 60% to 52%. Mm-hmm. So that's, you know, an 8% market share there, at least with that shortest term contract that has gone directly to this new Chinese contract.
And that would represent how much money?
I'm not sure about the monetary amount or the exact, you know, barrels of oil, but it's for that smallest shortest term contract, though, it is a really significant percentage of these massive volumes and dollar amounts.
So it's almost like we were talking earlier about these tunnels that Iran has been digging. This is something that doesn't take place overnight. This is years worth of work. Really, what we're seeing China doing here, this is something that it's been laying the groundwork for some time. And you have other nations looking at this, and it does seem like we've talked about just how investors the world over have been hoping for some kind of alternative to the dollar. It seems like the success that this one exchange has seen just in 8 months reflects that desire, how much there is a desire for an alternative to the dollar.
Yes, that's exactly right. So many of the sanctions that the U.S. levies on nations like Russia and Iran are based on trade and based on the U.S. dollar. Basically, if it's not a United Nations sanctions package, then it has to be a dollar-based unilateral American sanctions package. And if the value of the dollar were eroded, those kinds of sanctions would have no bite at all. Mm. So countries like Venezuela, Iran, and Russia would love to move away from the dollar. They would love to latch on to the yuan. There have been plenty of reasons for them not to do so, mostly the Chinese government pegs the yuan artificially and disincentivizes people, wanting to adopt it in a number of ways, just with these heavy-handed government-controlled tactics. But it looks like China's trying to correct for that and enjoying some success there.
So if the dollar loses its stature, that has dramatic implications and prophetic implications that we've been talking about for some time. Maybe you could discuss that.
Sure. Yeah, for some 50 years, The Trumpet and our forerunner magazine, The Plain Truth, have said that there will be a financial crisis originating in the United States that'll end up transforming the world's, its whole geopolitical landscape. Back in 1968, Mr. Herbert W. Armstrong, the editor-in-chief of The Plain Truth, wrote, quote, "If the dollar is devalued, inflation will almost surely result in eventual economic collapse for the U.S." And Mr. Armstrong explained that his forecast there was founded on Bible passages such as those in Leviticus 26 and Deuteronomy 28, just, passages that say, if the people of the U.S. reject God and his law, then he would send curses upon the nation. And then after that, Mr. Armstrong wrote, quote, "Those of you who truly believe the prophecies of your Bible know such an economic collapse is prophesied to happen. God prophesied a virtual trade war will get underway against the U.S. and Britain, and our national economies will falter and then collapse." End quote. So if China's new oil futures contract continues to lure more oil exporting nations away from the dollar and toward the yuan, it could really, continue to work toward weakening the dollar and just create the conditions for that prophesied collapse that Mr. Armstrong wrote about and spoke about on so many occasions.
Well, Jeremiah has written an article that should be going up on the website soon. China intensifies efforts to topple U.S. dollar. You can find that on the website. And also check out the chapter in our booklet, He Was Right, called Our Financial 9/11 Was Prophesied, that gets into more of the details of these the economic besiegement that's taking place against the United States and what that means prophetically. Lots of good information in those articles. We appreciate that, Jeremiah. In a world where the rule of law is breaking down in many countries, we're seeing an alarming rise in vigilantism. Citizens who don't trust the police are taking the law into their own hands. For this story, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, the two areas of the world with the highest murder rates are South Africa and Latin America. And so it should come as a little surprise that these are the two areas that are experiencing a major surge in vigilantism, as you mentioned. People who are tired of rising crime, tired of these high murder rates, realizing that their governments are corrupt, the police are not able to get a handle on the situation, and so you're now starting to get mobs to take the law into their own hands. There's been a couple pretty big stories in some pretty big papers in the media this week about this. The Wall Street Journal published an article titled, "In Latin America, Awash with Crime, Citizens Impose Their Own Brutal Justice." where they go through just some of these statistics about, like, lynching is Latin America's dark secret. The region has the world's highest murder rate. They said now, according to one university in San Paulo, in Brazil, there's at least one vigilante killing a day. And then even mentioning into Mexico, it's not in this article in particular, but like villages in Mexico where the government's not able to get a handle on drug cartels. And so you get these citizens militias that just do like their own people's court, wherever you catch someone suspected of a drug crime, they're just drugged to the town square, have whatever patriarch of the town makes a decision. So there's definitely like trial by jury and all those habeas corpus and all these legal rights you take for granted in the United States have kind of gone out the window as people are just even using some of the same tactics that criminals use to create crimes to fight back against the criminals who are creating those crimes.
Right. And this Wall Street Journal article that you referenced, it begins with this account of not somebody who was actually dragged into the middle of a town square and given at least some kind of a hearing by someone that might have a certain impartiality, but someone who essentially, there was a woman who had her phone stolen and was accused. She turned around and saw somebody and accused him, and he was beaten to death on the spot by people who just took the law into their own hands in a very, very brutal way. And the man was innocent, but the mob didn't even.
Right. That's what you get when you get these, like I said, vigilante killings like that. Even in the United States, the justice system makes mistakes occasionally, and that's with all these checks and balances and lawyers and stuff like that. When you're getting here, where it's that you just scream out that someone stole my phone, and then you've got this attitude that, like, well, we need to take care of this on the spot. Mm-hmm. The motive might be a little more altruistic than a drug trafficker, but the result is kind of scarily similar.
Mm-hmm. So, and then what's happening in South Africa?
South Africa is similar. It's, we've covered on this program a lot of the killings of targeted racial killings of white farmers, but they also talk about just like this black on black crime in South Africa and like the shanty towns and the poorer neighborhoods where the crime rate's high and they know the police are corrupt. You're seeing a similar thing like they have in Brazil and Latin America, where people are just taking the law into their own hands. I guess according to South Africa's national crime statistics, which are notoriously incomplete, there's been at least 850 mob justice killings, as they term it, in the last year.
So you looking at these stories, you can't help but view this in light of, say, what's happening in the United States, where there's been an erosion of trust in law enforcement in particular and government institutions in general. And you can see where that kind of mentality leads.
Right. There is definitely erosion of trust. I mean, polls show that trust in the government's at, I don't know if it's all-time lows, but definitely almost all-time lows. You're getting some of these same drug trafficking networks that the vigilantes are fighting in Latin America crossing the border. We covered on this program a couple weeks ago about citizen militias heading towards the Mexican border. And now those militias are in a little different vein, as at least right now they're just observing and reporting. If any illegal immigrants are crossing, they'll report it to the government, report it to the troops. But it is still a vigilante action, is that they're not officials and they're not, they haven't been asked to do this, and the military is even a little miffed that they're these untrained militias are trying to stick their nose in government business. Mm-hmm. But that is kind of like the beginning stages of that same trend, where you'll see that intensify. And we do have a book that I don't actually mention on this program as much, but it's by our editor-in-chief, Mr. Gerald Fleury, entitled The Former Prophets, How to Be a King. And it's got a section in there where it's going through the Book of the Judges, and it explains that the Book of the Judges is it's actually a prophetic book. The lessons they learned in the time of the Judges are relevant to America and Britain today.
And that's one thing, if you read the book of the Judges, it just seems like every few chapters you've got this verse they repeat that says, in those days there was no king in Israel, but every man did what was right in his own eyes. Mm-hmm. So I explain that. That is a prophecy today for, like I said, the United States and Britain in particular. But it is part of this trend you're seeing on the south side of the Rio Grande, that someday is going to become like the north side of the Rio Grande, to where trust in the government and rising crime get so bad that, like I said, every person just kind of has to take the law into their own hands, do what's right in their own eyes.
Quite a chilling trend. We appreciate you bringing that to us. You're listening to Trumpet Hour. Coming up, Iran intensifying its missile program, right-wing populism entering the Spanish parliament for the first time in decades, Japan's new aircraft carrier that isn't an aircraft carrier, and the trouble that the United States is having in funding its military. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
U.S. officials have been calling out Iran for intensifying its illegal missile development, and Iran is proving to be in no mood to back down. For this story, we'll go back to Jerusalem and Brent Noctegal.
Yeah, this was earlier on in the week. Mr. Mike Pompeo, the Secretary of State, declared that Iran had just done another ballistic missile test. This is a test that where Iran fired a missile that can reach into southern Europe, anywhere in the Middle East. It's capable of carrying multiple nuclear warheads. And this is something that the nuclear deal and the UN Security Council resolutions that based on the nuclear deal does forbid, or at least the resolution calls on Iran to stop ballistic missile research that could be used in the event to carry a nuclear warhead. And Iran basically came out and said, I don't care what you say, United States, we're going to continue doing what we're doing. And this is actually drawing the ire of the Europeans who have just been bending over backwards to say to Iran, hey, we want to preserve the nuclear deal. Let us help you. We can do whatever. We're going to do anything we can. And then Iran's like, thanks very much for your help. You're not working fast enough. Meanwhile, we're going to continue developing the very missiles that can reach your sovereign territory. If that's not just a slap in the face of the Europeans, I don't know. But this is serious because, yes, Iran has slowed their nuclear development of their actual nuclear warhead. We know they have slowed that, or at least that looks like they've slowed. But they haven't stopped their furthering their abilities to deliver such a system. They said, hey, let's agree to the nuclear deal because, hey, we don't even have the weapon that we need to put the nuclear warhead on. And so meanwhile, through all this time, they've just been working on their ballistic missile technology so that they can deliver those nuclear weapons. And it doesn't look like they're letting up in that at all.
It's amazing. We talked in the first half about these tunnels into Israel, proving Iran's determination to wage war against Israel. These provocations regarding its missile program are yet more proof, more evidence of just that the fact that Iran is who the Bible says that it is. Gerald Fleury, again, just pointing back to what he has said about Iran being the king of the south, and you look at Daniel's prophecy, and it just says that it is pushy. It's going to push specifically at Europe, and this is absolute evidence that the way that he has been looking at this since, what, around 1992, going on two decades now, is exactly what we see happening. Well, thank you for that, Brent. The rise of the right. This is a major story in Europe that we've been following for some time. We saw this again in elections in Spain this past Sunday. For this story, we'll go back to Richard Palmer.
So until the late 70s, Spain was literally a dictatorship. They're one of the newer democracies in Europe. And because of this, they've been immune from this trend that we've seen across Europe. You know, we've talked about country after country where the far right has been rising, the far right's been gaining seats in parliament, these record-breaking figures. We've heard nothing from Spain. despite all of the upheaval that they've had with the euro crisis going back a few years, we've had certainly a lot of political paralysis. We've seen certainly a lot of new parties start up in Spain. We've had a fair share of government chaos, but the rise of the far right hasn't, to the same scale that it's been in the rest of Europe, hasn't been an issue until now. So their most populous region held an election this week that was in Andalusia. I was toying with trying to avoid saying it so I wouldn't have to butcher the pronunciation.
It sounded good, Richard. I think you're okay.
Especially when it's Spanish. Everyone knows how to say Spanish things apart from me.
just an instinct.
But anyway, they've done really well in this particular place. They've won 11% of the vote. This is a new right-wing party. It's called Vox, and it's pretty close to what used to be the National Front in France. They're now called French National Rally. They've also been described as being very similar to the alternative for Deutschland. And this is the first time since the 70s that they've been able to have that a far right party's been able to gain seats at all in a regional assembly. Now they've got 10%, and people are also looking at this election in this most populous state and saying, well, this is probably going to tell us how things are going to play out when we have a national election, and that these guys are almost certainly going to enter the national parliament soon. And what we've seen across Europe, when you start having these far-right parties do well, politics just starts gumming up and it's very hard to function because they take away so many seats that it's hard for either the mainstream left or mainstream right to gain a majority by themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Spain, you've got added complications. So Catalonia, for example, it's a big issue in Spain. Catalans want independence, and there's a lot of times if you want a coalition, one of your main options might be working with one of the Catalan pro-independence groups, and so you might give them not full independence, but maybe they get to determine more of how their money's spent or devolving power. Now you've got this party, Vox, they're dead against Catalan independence. They're pretty much the Catalan, they're at the exact opposite end of the extreme. They want to abolish Spain's federal system. They want to make it all top down from the government. And so now this is just, their success has made Spanish politics a whole lot more complicated because now parties have got to think about, well, if we move too close to the Catalans, are we going to then lose a lot of votes to these guys on the right? If we go with these guys on the right, then we won't be able to form any coalitions with the Catalan independence groups, even though we may agree with them on a lot of points. And so now you've got that added dysfunction, and then you've got the potential for that to stir up the Catalan independence movement and to bring back some of the unrest there. It also ties into the migrant crisis. This Vox party is very strong against migrants. So you see this tying perfectly in with the same trend that you see all across Europe. The rise of the far right and then just democracy as normal becoming increasingly hard to function.
The story that we talk about with so many of these other European countries is the fact that this type of disruption politically is paving the way for the strongman, the firebrand. That's exactly what we see in Bible prophecy. It talks about 10 kings within Europe. And this seems like this very much in line with that.
That's right. I mean, we've been talking a lot on this show about the rise of a strongman within Germany. That's not a guy that's very democratic. That was even the cover of our latest Trumpet issue about an article related to this coming strongman that's going to lead Europe. And then the Bible in Revelation 17, in places like verse 10, it talks about other kings under this strongman, 10 kings, and they're under a strongman. They're called kings. They are quite plainly not democratic leaders. And so when you see the rise of these far right groups, you see a growing appetite for that kind of king-like leadership. But then B, it just, this not king-like leadership that they have today, it stops that from working. And, well, what's the alternative? If democracy ceases to function, how do we move forwards? And in the 1930s, in so many countries across Europe, the answer was with an authoritarian leader, with somebody who will ignore all the democratic norms, ignore the votes, and just get things done. And so you see, in the rise of the far right, a symptom of that desire for a strong leader and the conditions that are just going to make that desire stronger as all of those political systems stop working in just one country after another after another. We have an article from earlier in the year called Introducing Europe's Eastern Strongmen, and that's a great place to go to learn more about this trend. It's a trend that is already underway in Eastern Europe, and that article will take you through that. But then that article will also take you through in detail some of those Bible prophecies, like the one we mentioned in Revelation 17, that describe these kings and even to a certain extent how they are going to rise. So that's Introducing Europe's Eastern Strongmen.
All right. Thank you very much for that, Richard. This is Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3. Back to Asia now. Japan has been remilitarizing for some time, but it's going about it in crafty ways so as not to openly violate its pacifist constitution. And at times, these efforts become almost comical, as is the case with this next story. For this, we'll go back to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, Japan's defense minister has announced that Japan will adapt its Uzumo destroyer into something remarkably like an aircraft carrier. The updated guidelines for this revision say, quote, the government will make considerations so that fixed-wing aircraft, such as fighter jets, can take off from and land on vessels. And the specific unnamed jets in question there are the F-35Bs that Japan is currently in the process of purchasing from the United States. Japan has recently finalized plans to buy 40 of those from America, and those are able to take off and land vertically. Mm. So it makes it a perfect aircraft for a smaller deck, such as this Izumo destroyer. And we've spoken about the Izumo destroyers a few times on Trumpet Hour in the past. It was commissioned back in 2015. And when it first came into service, the Japanese government was emphatic that it was not an aircraft carrier. It was Japan's largest warship to come into service since World War II. But because of Japan's pacifist constitution, the leadership there really went out of their way to brand it as something that was strictly defensive, you know, just for self-defense. And they said it was strictly a helicopter destroyer and just emphasized that it was you know, basically nothing more than a floating helicopter pad. And there was always some suspension of disbelief required, you know, here, because this is just such an advanced warship and it's 800 feet, you know, that's the length with deep water capability. It always required a little bit of doublethink, really, to see this as something that's strictly for self-defense. But with these new revisions that Japan just announced, they're really dispensing with some of that branding, I guess, which is largely fictitious. And they're saying, yes, we will have the world's most advanced jets on there. And yes, since they can take off and land vertically, Japan will have an ability to operate fighter jets at sea, which they've not had since World War II. But yet they're still maintaining that this is only for self-defense. They say that it's just to help Japan defend some of its faraway islands, some of the islands that are pretty far from the mainland there. But it is a big development, I think, and it shows that Japan's march toward remilitarization is gaining momentum.
They're saying that it's for defense purposes, and they're still saying it's not an aircraft carrier.
Right. They say it's an effective aircraft carrier. So I'm not sure exactly what that means. They sometimes refer to it as a mothership instead of an aircraft carrier. But yes, they say we're going to have 6 to 8 F-35Bs on these within 4 years.
So why is Japan remilitarizing?
Well, it's partly due to Japan's increasing fear of China. You know, Japan is an island nation with very, very few resources. It's utterly dependent on maritime lanes in the South China Sea and in the East China Sea to bring in the oil and the raw materials that it needs to just fuel its economy. And China right now is increasingly trying to take over all these lanes, which we often discuss on Trumpet Hour. So Japan just feels very threatened, existentially threatened even, by China's increasing adventurism in its backyard there. And the Japanese really feel that they need a full-fledged military, including this aircraft carrier, to prevent China being able to block those vital sea lanes. And then the other reason is just that the United States is not seen as being as reliable as it used to be in terms of being able to guarantee Japan's security. Mm-hmm. You know, ever since the end of World War II, we've had Japan underneath the American security umbrella. We've said, if anything happens to you, we will come to your defense. But you know, in recent years, especially under President Trump, who often encourages America's Asian allies to spend more on their own militaries, to rely less on America, to take on more of the financial burden of being able to contain China's rise. With those trends happening, Japan is saying we really need to dispense with all these hindrances and, mm-hmm. and the so-called pacifist clause, which has not really kept them from having a military at all. It's only been in name, but now they're even in name, they're beginning to very quickly move away from pacifism for those reasons.
Well, we do have an article going up on thetrumpet.com. When is an aircraft carrier not an aircraft carrier, about this very subject? And we also, you might want to check out a trend that we have on the website, why the Trumpet watches Japan's march toward militarism, that puts this in its historic and prophetic context. Thank you for that, Jeremiah. One final story. Can America afford its military? There are other budget items that threaten America's ability to continue funding its presence in other parts of the world militarily. For this story, we'll go to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, since the end of World War II, really, America's been what you'd consider the world's policeman. They've got over 800 military bases around the world, spend roughly a fifth of its military budget on those overseas bases to protect Europeans from Russia and to protect Asians from China and to protect Middle Easterners from Iran and to keep these world trade routes open and more or less enforcing what they call the Pax Americana, the American peace. There's been no major world wars for 60, 70 years because of America's role this way. But now with the national debt up above $21 trillion and the budget deficit set to be about $780 billion, you're starting to feel the financial squeeze. President Trump's called for all the cabinet departments to slash their budgets by 5% by the year 2020. For the military, that's going to mean about a $33 billion cut in national defense. Now, the military budget's big enough that $33 billion, if you do it strategically, could be cut probably fairly easily just by looking for redundancies and cut wasteful spending. But when you look at the budget projections, this is just the first drop in the bucket, because you're already this year, the national debt is so high that just the interest on the debt is half of what we spend on the military. Mm. And within 5 years, by 2023, it's expected that the interest on the debt will be more than we spend on the military.
It's not far away.
And then with Social Security and healthcare rising as well, I mean, within the next 10 years, you're going to be spending pretty much all tax revenues on three budget items, retirement, healthcare, and interest on the debt. Which means that the entire rest of the government, including defense, is going to have to be run off debt. Mm-hmm. And so the military, there's going to have to be cuts coming. And a number of analysts think that it's going to be the overseas military bases that are going to be the first item to go as you slash that 20% of the military budget to focus on protecting the American homeland. Mm-hmm. Which will leave all these theaters around the world, sea gates, trade routes, and stuff like that open for other foreign aggressive powers.
Yeah, the implications of the United States withdrawing from those theaters is quite significant, and it does tie in with several biblical prophecies that show America's waning influence in the closing days of this age of man ruling over man, and other powers stepping in to fill that void to really nightmarish effect. Is very clear what Bible prophecy says about that. Andrew has just posted a video on thetrumpet.com about this and also written an article that expands on it in more detail in the coming print edition of The Trumpet. We're working on that. That will be going to the printer in a couple of weeks. But this is definitely a subject that's not going away. It's only going to become more important in the time ahead. But check out what Andrew is putting together on this subject to get advanced news of headlines that you're going to be reading more and more about in the time ahead. We appreciate that, Andrew. I'm Joel Hilliker. That'll do it for today's Trumpet Hour. You can visit the Trumpet Hour Hub on thetrumpet.com for links to the articles and the literature that we discussed on the program today. You can also email your thoughts to us about this program. Just send that to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to our panel, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, Richard Palmer, and Brent Noctegal.
Pleasure to be here.
Thanks for having me.
Have a great weekend.
Have a good weekend.
Thanks to our staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. And I'll leave you with the words of Julie Andrews. Perseverance is failing 19 times and succeeding the 20th. Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.